Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I have the Genesis team back. I've been promising, and we've kind of all had interesting summers where it's been a little bit hard to reconnect, and we managed. And we are going to pick up the story where we left off, which is basically we did the Akedah. We did the binding of Isaac last time, and now we're going to move in. We're going to skip over the death of Sarah and Abraham's buying the cave, in which will be an ancestral burying place, and we'll kind of, see that come up a couple of other times throughout the series. But we're just going to go right to 24 of Genesis and begin with the story of Abraham sending the servant to find a wife for his son Isaac. Let me just quickly have the guys introduce themselves again. David Bacavoy, you're kind of our narrator and taking us through the text. Would you remind everybody a little bit about your background?
I'm David Bacavoy. I have a PhD in Hebrew Bible and the Ancient Near East from Brandeis University. Teach courses in Bible, Biblical Hebrew at the University of Utah.
Awesome. Thank you. And you have a book called Authoring the Old Testament that came out, and everybody's loving it.
It's received positive reviews. I've been really pleased that so many people have connected with my efforts to try and help an LDS audience make sense of critical biblical scholarship in light of their spiritual convictions. I've been working this summer on Volume 2, which covers the prophets. That's been exciting, and I hope to have that done by, for the next couple months or so.
Awesome. Man, looking forward to it. Father Tom Roberts from up in Weezer, Idaho right now. Would you quickly let everybody know what you're doing and who you are?
I'm Father Tom Roberts. I lead the PhD and oversee an online school named St. Elias Orthodox Seminary. And we have a PhD program in 5 languages, and I also do staff development and recruitment and oversee our academic programs. The book I promote is my doctoral dissertation called From Sacral Kingship to Sacred Marriage, where we take temple endowments and other liturgical elements and tie them through the salvation history of the biblical text, so you can actually see coronations and other ceremonies give the divine right of kings the right to speak for Yahweh. Then our ministry, the Sacral Kingship of Christ, is at my Facebook page, and then we direct you to our online study papers about the Kingdom of God, the Aramaic background of the Gospels, and other interesting topics. We're working with Sowers of the Seed ministry now, so we can actually promote biblical realism as an alternative interpretation to have the natural reading of the text come forward. So we've got my courses listed on the Old Testament survey and a synopsis of the New Testament. So, you know, there's a lot of things we're trying to bring to the general public to add critical thinking to the Christian and believing community.
Nice. And thank you, too, for all the work that you do with Mormons and in cross-dialogue with Mormon traditions.
Well, we love them very much, and we have more in common than we think we do.
Yes, we do. Awesome. Thanks so much, brother. Brian Haugland, thank you for coming back. You're our Islamic guy, as well as just a strong background in CES and various academic Mormon stuff. Would you quickly remind everybody a little about your background?
Sure. I'm in the Ancient Scripture Department at BYU, and I'm also at the Maxwell Institute. I direct the Willis Center Book of Mormon Studies. And as you said, my PhD is in Arabic and Islamic studies, but I've done a lot with Jewish stuff as well. And I think I'm going to bring a little bit of that into the discussion today. So
great.
Just kind of forewarn you there. So
I love it. Yeah, well, that's been missing sometimes. So I'm glad that you're always alerted to it. I know, David, you talk a lot about Midrash and Jewish commentary and things like that, but we haven't really added too much into it. So grateful to have Brian and anybody feel free on any of that. Well, team, let's get going here. Genesis 24. David, would you kind of take the typical lead you are and get us going here on this this commission to at least what sounds like the main servant of Abraham?
This is a wonderful chapter. Very interesting. It has an importance in LDS thought and tradition. We emphasize it a lot in our Sunday school, seminary, and institute classes. As is typical for our broadcast, I'm going to follow the King James translation and supplement it as needs be, because that will be the version that will be most familiar to our audience. So in Genesis chapter 24, we read in the first verse that Abraham was very old. He was well stricken in age. I love the repetition that the King James emphasizes there, emphasizing that Abraham really has gone through a lot at this stage in his life. He's at the very end, and so we're preparing to transition into the next patriarchal leader in the story of Genesis. And that repetition prepares us as readers for that. And we read that the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things, tying back to that cycle, if our audience will recall, that we discussed where Abraham, reading the account synchronically, goes through covenant frustration, covenant renewal, and this very difficult ordeal. Yet, at the end, God had blessed him in all things. Well, in verse 2, then, Abraham says unto his eldest servant of his house that ruled over all that he had, he tells him to do something very interesting. In the King James, put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh. Now, the LDS audience will recognize that the JST changes this to put your hand under my hand, to try and make sense of this more from a contemporary perspective of what's happening ritually with this sacred ritual gesture, where Abraham is trying to commit this servant to do exactly what he says, and to do so with a ritual gesture that seems very strange and odd from our perspective. There's some suggestion that perhaps what's happening here is that he's actually grabbing hold of Abraham's genitals. And that's because it's a sign of the covenant and making an oath. In the same way that the foreskin has been removed from the penis, if he does not fulfill this charge that he's received, he too will be cut off, or that his posterity will no longer be blessed. And it's an odd gesture without question. It's difficult to know exactly what's going on there, but
yeah, it is an interesting gesture, and if I'm remembering right from Spicer, the author of the Anchor Bible commentary, it's almost like even perhaps by doing this, the curse on the servant would be sterility or the end of his own posterity line or something like that. I should have looked more carefully at it. But there's another piece about this whole thigh business. David, you know, later when we talk about Jacob's wrestle with the angel and he ends up, you know, getting an injury to his thigh, his hip gets put out of joint or something like that. And I know that some people have been reading that as some sort of ritual covenantal situation, just like this, where in the wrestle with Yahweh, with the angel, with whoever it is, we'll get to that, but that there's some covenanting going on there, and that puts his hip out of joint. Is there anything to that, in your opinion?
Yeah, no, perhaps there is. It'll be interesting to explore that, but really, in the context of ancient Near Eastern covenant making, there is quite frequently a ritual gesture connected with punishment for violation of the covenant. And that Spicer's commentary on that is you know, still taken seriously by contemporary scholars. Difficult to say precisely what's going on. From my perspective as a believing Latter-day Saint, what I see the prophet Joseph Smith doing in his change here, in reference to the hand as opposed to the thigh, is not so much restoring what the original biblical author intended regarding this ritual gesture or performance, but rather trying to give a contemporary Latter-day Saint audience an understanding of what was taking place here based upon Joseph Smith's 19th century context. So, in other words, in Joseph Smith's day, how do we solidify a sacred agreement or accord? It's with a handshake. And ultimately, yeah, that's what I believe is happening there with the JST.
Well, some scholars also link this liturgically later because of the term heaven and earth being invoked, that's also in Deuteronomy 30, that it's a covenant proclamation that will also later result in a name change, as well as we see this even echoed in Revelation chapter 3 much later in the biblical text, where liturgically this will become very important to church worship at a much later date.
So you're saying anytime that they invoke heaven and earth, it's always going to be a name change?
And if they talk about the thigh, we see echoes of this in Revelation 3, verse 10 through 3:14, even in the New Testament, where new names are given, because it's telling you that's also what's coming.
Okay, but even though Isaac never has his name changed.
Right, right.
Okay, but right. Jay knows the whole story, so he's writing it here with that probably in the back of his mind. So that's interesting.
Can I just add one other point there?
Please.
On the thigh, when David mentioned the genitals, you can see when you're going to verse 3 there that it leads to talking about a wife. And posterity is so important, of course, to these people of antiquity, that if it were, referring to genitals, that would fit totally into the context here. Isn't also, this ritual act with the genitals? I remember when I was in Pompeii just a few weeks ago, where you have a lot of phallic symbols on the walls and such. And of course, Latter-day Saints are automatically thinking porn, but it really wasn't that. It was that there's something about that phallic symbol that indicates power and supremacy and such. That goes all the way back to Romans and Greeks. And correct me if I'm wrong, David, but it looks like it goes back way to the ancient Near East.
Excellent.
thought maybe we should at least add that little point there.
That's excellent. And I love the thematic transition then from the, from the genital gesture here into the posterity and the marriage that we see in verse 3, I will make thee, this is Abraham speaking to the servant, swear by the Lord, notice that it is Yahweh, and therefore as this is part of the J source, by Yahweh, the God of heaven and the God of the earth, that thou shalt not take a wife unto my son of the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I dwell, but thou shalt go, this is verse 4, unto my country and unto my kindred, and take a wife unto my son Isaac. So, Brian, that was just beautiful. And I'll pick up for a minute then on what Father Tom mentioned regarding the God of heaven and the God of earth. That is a polar expression or merismus, where two opposite words are used to refer to all or everything. So, for example, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, God creates heaven and earth. Well, he creates the entirety of the cosmos. The man and the woman partake of the fruit of the knowledge of good and bad, meaning they can gain a knowledge of all things. It's a common literary pattern in the Hebrew Bible and in other ancient Near Eastern texts. The interesting thing then, going back to what Father Tom referred to in the context of covenant making, in documents from the world of the Bible, heaven and earth were used as polar expression to refer to all of the gods of the council. So it was a way of summing up all of the gods that occupy the entirety of the cosmos, who were invoked in the context of covenant making as witnesses to solidify the validity of the covenant making and hold the parties, the respective parties, accountable for what was being covenanted to. So that's kind of interesting, because here you see this biblical perspective of Yahweh as the God of the entirety of the council, holding the council, perhaps, and the gods there alluded to as witnesses in the covenant-making process here to find a proper wife for Isaac.
There's also another piece to this, gentlemen, if I may add this, Yeah, ancient Near Eastern documents also talk about the gods of heaven and earth and this, you know, universal witness from Yahweh and the High Council as also the phallic symbol that God released himself cosmically, you know, in the creation that he is bearing witness to. In Deuteronomy 30, that results in the siring of not only the universe, but also the genealogy that we're about to unfold. So God is acting as a siring type of thing, which gives him dominance.
Very nice. Very nice.
Keep us going, well, David.
Okay, to pick it up then, I think that our LDS audience will be very familiar with this account because of gospel doctrine, Sunday school, seminary, institute classes, where we use this to emphasize from an LDS perspective the importance of marriage within the covenant and of proper priesthood lines and authority. And we take it in a way that may, as applicable as it may be for a contemporary LDS audience, is not necessarily reflective of the original author's intent. Really, what we see here, I think, is a desire on the part of the biblical authors to emphasize the fact that their ancestors were separate and distinct from the indigenous population of Canaan. We were not Canaanites. Canaanites are the bad guys. We are the good guys. And so the emphasis is given that Abraham, the original ancestral patriarchal figure, comes from Ur in southern Mesopotamia. He comes at an early stage in history and occupies portions of the land, but notice that he really never interacts with any of the indigenous population. That's also true really for Isaac and Jacob. So they're always kind of separate and distinct from the Canaanites. They'll go down into Egypt and then they'll return back and forth. And so that establishes basically a political right since to the land because they were there for quite some time. But it also emphasizes the fact that these ancestors of ours, the Israelites, are not Canaanites. That's a separate people, and it really has a strong political message that we sometimes miss as contemporary readers.
And that helps make sense of stuff that happens in future verses where, you know, sporting with Rebecca later, and the king is like, how could you have brought such possible trouble to us and get out of here, and then later they make big deals with each other. Please don't crush us. Yeah, it kind of does show this separation.
Absolutely. In fact, perhaps at this stage I could draw attention to a wonderful book that just was released about maybe a year ago by Yale University Press. It was written by an Israeli scholar by the name of Yair Zakovich, and the book is entitled Jacob, Unexpected Patriarch. It's a wonderful resource, and I would I'd like to draw attention to something that this Israeli scholar wrote on page 6 of the book that I think is really relevant for what you're saying, Dan. He writes these words, "Even a rough sketch of the patriarch's wanderings coincides with the broad lines traced by later generations. Canaan is located between the two great powers of Mesopotamia and Egypt, and the patriarchs make their way between the three points, Mesopotamia, Canaan, and Egypt. Abraham sets out from Mesopotamia and arrives in Canaan. Before much time passes, he descends to Egypt and then returns to Canaan. His son Isaac never leaves Canaan, but his grandson Jacob, the hero of our book, leaves for Mesopotamia, for Haran, the city from which his grandfather had originally set out, and returns from there after a 20-year exile. At the end of his life, Jacob travels with his entire household to Egypt to unite with his son Joseph. These subsequent journeys reach their conclusion when the generation that leaves Egypt returns to Canaan, led by Joshua ben Nun. In the bitter final chapters of the Book of Kings, however, the people return once more to Mesopotamia when the inhabitants of the Kingdom of Israel are exiled to Assyria. And the pattern of wandering is completed later with the exile of the people of Judah to Babylon." And why I think that's so helpful, Dan, is because it illustrates the importance that the ancestors have for typifying the journeys that the kingdom of Judah, the kingdom of Israel, will later experience. If we, as is sometimes done amongst a few LDS scholars in their efforts to link the book of Abraham with historical events that we can have in the ancient Near East, try to locate Abraham in away from Mesopotamia, then that really destroys thematically what we see happening with these ancestors. As they journey back and forth between Mesopotamia to Canaan down to Egypt, which reflects the later historical realities of Judah, Israel, the exile, and things that are so important for understanding the overall literary structure to the entire Hebrew Bible.
So what you're saying, David, is that the patriarchs' lives and travels sort of prefigure what's going on later with Judah and Israel?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so, again, returning to the reason I linked this here at this point, it's a desire on the part of the authors, I believe, to show that they are not Canaanites. So Isaac cannot have a Canaanite wife. He has to go and receive a wife from Mesopotamia. And this is reflective of the political reality where the Israelites are trying to distinguish themselves from the indigenous population ethnically, religiously, culturally. And yet, the interesting thing is that the archaeological evidence suggests that the Israelites emerge ethnically from Canaan itself, so that they really are just a subset of the greater Canaanite population, at least from an archaeological perspective. There was probably a small group of ancestors that were slaves in Egypt and that come and occupy some of the central hill region in the land of Canaan and merge then with the greater Canaanite population from an historical perspective. But there really is a desire on the part of the biblical authors to override perhaps what was historical reality and emphasize the uniqueness of Israelite ancestry. Yeah.
A lot going on, brother. Well, good. But let's go do the story and just pick the interesting parts. Again, like you said before, we're going to know this story.
So the servant then, in essence, just to summarize, agrees to this and takes off with a series of gifts to present to this bride-to-be, goes to Haran to be able to secure a wife for Isaac.
And this is bride price. This is all this stuff that has to happen in the ancient days whenever you get a wife, right? You have to bring a bunch of good stuff to her family.
Exactly, exactly. So of course, this is always the case in a good romantic story in the Hebrew Bible. He goes to a well because the well becomes a type scene that allows for a story of encountering the bride-to-be. So you have, for example, remember Moses goes to the well and he meets his wife there. Jacob later will go to the well and meet the love of his life at a well. Wells become the symbol for marriage, fertility. There's lots of reasons why they draw upon this and emphasize it. But he goes to the well.
Well, plus they're good gathering places. Everybody kind of has to show up at the well,
sure.
Right?
And Brother Dan, it's one of the few places a man could speak to a woman publicly.
Oh, that's an interesting point.
If we read the Bible synchronically from Old Testament to New Testament, when you're familiar with this idea of the husband meeting the wife at the well and this motif, it does present an interesting connection with the New Testament story in John where Jesus goes to the well and meets this Samaritan woman. And we as an audience kind of wonder, well, what's going to happen here? Is this some sort of, what's the relationship going to be between Jesus and this Samaritan woman? So I think what's interesting here then is that in all these other stories, we see the patriarchal ancestor or prophetic figure go to the well himself. But here, Isaac, despite the fact that he is, 30, 40 years old or whatever, according to the account, he doesn't go himself to secure this wife. It really does help us recognize, I think, that Isaac is an extremely passive figure in the Hebrew Bible. He's always acted upon, not only for, in this instance, when someone secures a wife for him, but later on when that same wife is going to take matters into her own hands and see that the proper son receives the birthright. So he's very, very passive as a character in the text.
Very transitional, too, isn't he, in the narrative?
Yes. Yes, it's all, I think, Tom, you mentioned earlier when we weren't on air that it's almost as if the author said, okay, let's hurry and let's get to Jacob.
Exactly, in the Abraham, Isaac, Jacob cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the servant does the prayer. It's like, here's what I want to have happen if it's the right person.
It really is a beautiful prayer. We should take a look at it in detail. He kneels down by the well of the water. This is verse 11. At the time of evening, when the women would go out to draw water, and he says, verse 12, O Lord God of my master Abraham, I pray thee, send me good speed this day, and show kindness unto my master Abraham. Behold, I stand here by the well of water, and the daughters of the men of the city come out to draw water. Let it come to pass that the damsel to whom I shall say, let down thy pitcher, I pray thee, that I may drink, and she shall say, drink, and I will give thee thy camel's drink also. And let the same be she that thou hast appointed for thy servant Isaac, and thereby shall I know that thou hast showed kindness unto my master. So it's a beautiful prayer, and it relies upon this theological view that there is, that Yahweh is in control, and he already has in his mind worked out who the proper matriarchal figure should be to continue this important line of Abraham. And it's really a wonderful test that he sets up, because really, if you think about what's happening here, I believe, Dan, it's suggesting that she's going to have a very specific virtuous characteristic, that she will, in good Near Eastern fashion, be hospitable to strangers to the point that she will not only willingly take care of this stranger's need, but she will also take care of his animals.
Is it a hardship to draw that much water to be able to take care of the camels?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not sure how much water a thirsty camel could drink.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is, like, how, you know, is her pitcher small? Is it a bunch of pulleys? Is it, it would have to be like every time she reached down, she'd only get a little bit, and she'd have to go back and back again and again. Is this like going to take her an hour or longer to do this extra thing for the camels?
Oh, easily, as it's portrayed here. But, and that, it gives us, we should emphasize the fact that the test is really set up to, all she needs to say is, yes, I'll give you water, and I'll also give your camels drink as well. And so then in verse 15, we read, it came to pass before he had done speaking. So he hasn't even finished the prayer yet. Behold. Now, that word behold, I believe we've discussed it in previous podcast. But the word behold is a translation of a Hebrew term that functions as a presentative from a grammatical perspective. And what that means is we shift from the omniscient narrator's perspective to the characters within the account. So behold. So it's like, all of a sudden, then look, from the servant's perspective, Rebecca came out, who was born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, and she's of the right ancestry. Then we read in verse 16 that she was beautiful to look upon. She's a virgin, and it emphasizes the virginity with the repetition, neither had any man known her. So we're excited as readers. We're at this point where we think, my goodness, this may be the woman. She went down to the well and filled her pitcher and came up. Now, this is often talked about because Near Eastern wells were quite frequently quite deep, and so she would have to go up and down stairs. We don't know how many stairs they're envisioning here, but it's not just a simple, like, Snow White's wishing well, where you just kind of bring up the water. It's a lot more effort to go up and down these stairs into a deep, ancient Near Eastern well. And the servant, verse 17, runs to meet her, and he says, let me, I pray thee, verse 17, drink a little water of thy pitcher.
So, quick interruption here. Are men not allowed to pull from the well? There was no way that he could go up and help her?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I would suspect that it certainly is typical work that is assigned to women, but I don't know that it was a specific cultural taboo for men to do that. I'm not sure. But we set it up here where he asked their question, will you give me water? Is she the right one? Verse 18, and she said, drink, my Lord. She hasted and let down her pitcher upon her hand and gave him drink. We're still not sure, though, is she going to fulfill the test? And when she had done giving him drink, she said, I will draw water for thy camels also. So she fulfills the requirements of the test and the prayer that the servant offers to God. And then this beautiful phrase, she adds of her own accord, until they have done drinking. So that's not even something that the servant had even asked for as he sets up this test, right? Remember, all he asked is that the woman will say, yeah, I'll give your camels drink also, which is a sign of her virtue and character to serve hospitably this man. And it's not only does she fulfill all of the hopes and dreams because she's of the proper lineage, she's not an indigenous Canaanite, she's a virgin, she'd never known a man, she's beautiful, everything seems perfect. And then she says, I will draw water for thy camels also, and adds, until they have done drinking. So she's even more perfect, more wonderful, more charitable, hospitable, even than the servant possibly could have hoped for. Then we have in verse 20 some very interesting verbs. We read that in her effort to serve this stranger, she hasted and she ran. And that will remind our audience of Genesis 18, verses 6 through 7. It's those are the exact same two verbs that are put together when we read about Abraham showing hospitality to strangers that come to his midst. And so this seems to be an intentional effort on the part of the narrator to use those two verbs in the sequence to show that this is a woman who has Abraham's qualities and characteristics. She is amazing. She really is, as we will move forward, the most powerful female figure in the Hebrew Bible. And this is one of the clues for that, because the narrator is specifically linking her qualities, characteristics, and attributes with Abraham, the premier patriarch of the narrative.
I think David is providing a marvelous cultural context that Hebrew students and students of the Near East, you know, have trouble, you know, bringing that into modern application, because the cultural and the, you know, structures are so different. And it's a challenge to all of us to know, well, you know, how much of this do we apply, you know, the bridal prices and things that were paid, you know. We know where it goes in the redemptive cycle, and how the authors expand on these narratives later, but it's very refreshing to go back and be reminded of the original context.
I love the connection to Abraham, David. That's really good.
Yeah, it is really good. I think it's very helpful, especially for a religious audience that sometimes feels concerned that women are overlooked in Scripture, and they are. And so anytime we can, as commentators, step back and look and see an emphasis being given to the qualities and attributes of a female character, I like to draw attention to that. We'll also see that later on as we move into the story in terms of her blessing that she receives. We should go ahead and jump forward then to the conclusion. In chapter 24, the servant identifies himself. He tells Rebecca's family about what's happened and how he set up this test. And then their response, if we go back to verse 50, is they say, wow, this thing really proceedeth from the Lord, meaning Yahweh. We cannot speak unto thee bad or good. But behold, Rebecca, verse 51, is before thee. Go and let her be thy master's son's wife, as the Lord hath spoken. So they just said, wow, this thing really has the divine stamp of approval all over it. So they turn to Rebecca and inquire of her, will you go? And her response in verse 58 is very powerful. She says, they say, wilt thou go with this man? And she said, completion formula, I will go. And it, of course, for an LDS audience, will remind them of Nephi in 1 Nephi 3:7, when the father, Lehi, asks, will you go? And he says, I will go do the things that the Lord hath commanded. And it really does emphasize her willingness to accept the will of divinity in her life. And then the blessing is so important, and it links with Abraham as well. They give her a blessing, verse 60, and they send it to her, thou art our sister, be thou the mother of thousands of millions, and let thy seed possess the gate of those which hate them. The only other time that we will see that same promise being given is in Genesis 22, verse 17, following the Akedah, where the angel will say, Abraham, because you've done this incredible sacrifice, your posterity will be numerous, and also thy seed will possess the gate of them that hate them. So she has this powerful female figure. Not only has Abraham-like qualities, but she's given the exact same patriarchal blessing as woman, as matriarch, that we see this powerful figure Abraham given at the conclusion of the Akedah.
You know, a little bit later, she kind of does some pretty provocative things, almost like puppet master stuff, and where you could kind of, I don't know, like not appreciate her that much in terms of spirituality. So it's kind of nice to have the J writer really emphasize some neat qualities that she does have.
Yeah, definitely. And she is the puppet master, and I think that's also very powerful. She's so powerful because, you know, Isaac's passivity is matched by her active, powerful qualities and characteristics. So she's going to take matters into her own hands and get things done. And now that I've emphasized all of this, I'll say, and this is precisely why when it came time for me to choose the name for my second daughter, it was Rebecca. Spelled the exact same way as the King James spelling, just because she is just so powerful and wonderful and very active, and especially in this patriarchal environment. I love it.
There's another real interesting piece here. You know, she even prepared places for the camels. And then when we get to verses 63 and 64, you know, it says, he lifted up his eyes, referring to Isaac's. And then in Hebrew poetry, Rebecca lifted up her eyes, and she saw Isaac, who she had, dismounted from the camel. And you know, the plot thickens, the relationship, you know, is intensified. And I love Hebrew poetry in that case, you know, and how it plays off these parallelisms and merismas and other things, you know, that it's developing along the way.
Good. In fact, we see that presentative behold functioning again as a transition marker from omniscient narrator to, in this case, Isaac's perspective in the text. Isaac went out to meditate in the field at the eventide, and he lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, and now we switch to Isaac's perspective. Camels were coming. And then I love, Tom, yeah, the connection. Rebecca lifted up her eyes, and she saw Isaac, and she said, who is this person that's coming? And the servant said unto her, well, it's my master, it's your future husband. She takes a veil, covers herself, because he's not allowed to look at her until after the marriage. And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. And then verse 67 is absolutely beautiful. Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. And Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Beautiful.
Yeah. A lot going on there in just those few verses. And even Spicer, I think he kind of mentions just, or at least kind of tries to fill in something about how much the loss of Sarah had really affected her son Isaac there. So, interesting. And before we leave it, of course, earlier there we get the answer to the famous riddle of when was smoking first mentioned in the Bible? The answer is when Rebecca lighted off the camel, right?
There you go. Yes, there you go.
Brian, anything from your Judaic stuff that should be laid out here now?
Well, I just think it's interesting here with the, especially with the camels. I mean, camels in the desert are like life. You cannot live without them. They have milk. They travel. I mean, with the Arabian Peninsula, I mean, you've got, you know, love poetry to camels that some of the Arabs write very early on. And so it's really interesting to see Rebecca going and taking care of all the camels and making sure that they're all right. That's a powerful symbol there, I think, of who Rebecca is and what she's about. I like the way David put it, that she gets things done. And so I just wanted to kind of add that that, I mean, it's almost symbolic in a sense that she is, you know, water is power, and she's, you know, distributing that power to these creatures that make life, you know, that make life possible in such a hard environment. And so, is that about right, David?
I think that's beautifully said, Brian. And I wasn't aware of the Islamic poetry to camels, but that sounds pretty erotic to me. I'd like to read that.
I have heard of it in a Hebrew context, but I didn't know the Islamic scholars held that too.
Oh yeah, you have some camel stuff going on with Muhammad as well when he's a baby, and he's taken to a nursery. You know, he has to be weaned. The culture was to take them to, the mother to take the baby to a weaning nurse, and that nurse would wean. And when he went to where these weaning nurses were, none of them had any milk in their breasts. And so, but one of them, one of the less, let's say, less desirable people, her name was Halima. She just took the baby and put the baby in up to her breasts, even though they were empty, and they filled with milk automatically. And then all the other breasts filled with milk. It was just this, you know, this message of you know, that this young baby is very important. And so, I mean, I'm not saying that's connected to this story. I don't know if it is or not, but it just reminded me of that.
Yeah, all the prophets have to have something miraculous happen to them when they're young. Oh, interesting, interesting. Now, David, I don't know whether to bring it up here, but Spicer in his commentary kind of mentions that all the camel stuff here is probably anachronistic, that there wasn't really domesticated camels back in this time. And so, you know, this is just either them reading back from later, you know, to the former when camels were a bigger deal and everybody had them. Or I think it was Spicer who kind of also said something along the lines of, well, perhaps it's just a way of saying, guess what? He's rich. He's really rich. Here's a lot of camels.
Yes, most contemporary scholars hold the position that camels were not domesticated yet in the Middle East during the time period when these stories were taking place. There is some debate, of course, by conservative scholars who try to argue and counter that to give the account more historical validity. So, it goes back and forth. I tend to think the evidence is a little bit stronger in the lack of domesticated camels specifically during the patriarchal era, but it is open for debate.
Maybe they were tapirs, you know.
Yeah. Oh man.
These are great contextual points that I think we're all trying to make. To put the reader back in context to how wealth was measured, you know, through the amount of camels that you had, because they were a prized possession. And things we tend to read, you know, right over, you know, as believers, like the story of the camels, and it shows Rebecca's character and how much she thought of the person that she was serving, and it just serves as a wonderful backdrop to provide a proper context for the reading.
Right. Now, David, the J writer might not even have known he was being anachronistic, because by the time he's writing, camels are domesticated. And he you know, has these traditions that he's basically building on, and he probably isn't even maybe aware that he's throwing camels in there when there probably weren't any.
Yes, that's exactly correct. The stories about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the patriarchs, are based upon oral traditions that were passed down from generation to generation until they were put into the form that we have them now in the book of Genesis.
Right, and each generation would add details, and no one would really notice the changes.
Exactly, and this may be the perfect time to introduce our audience then to the theory that scholars refer to as the history of traditions. And if it's okay, maybe I'll take a second to define that. Many biblical scholars maintained that the traditions concerning the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were originally independent ancestral stories that were combined in the Genesis sources in order to define the relationship of the people of Israel to one another. So, for example, Benjamin and Judah, they appear linked as the brothers of the same mother in Genesis. Remember, those are the two sons of Jacob, who we're about ready to explore his story in greater detail here in just a minute. But his sons, Benjamin and Judah, are linked as brothers of the same mother. And that, according to some scholars, is because these two Israelite tribes were political allies in the southern kingdom. The ancestor stories were also created in such a way to connect the origins of Israel with Mesopotamia, so Abraham's original homeland rather than the land of Canaan. And Genesis, again, insists on distinguishing Israelites from Canaanites, who, as we've discussed in previous broadcasts, are defined throughout the Hebrew Bible as slaves and even sexual deviants. But the archaeological record, as we've discussed earlier, tells us a different story, that the Israelites actually were Canaanites in a very real sense. But reading the patriarchal stories from this perspective, it provides scholars with a different meaning, a different way of looking at the biblical traditions that we have in Genesis. So since the narratives about each patriarch in Genesis are connected with very clear geographical regions, some scholars look at this evidence to try and uncover historical clues about the original place where this oral tradition regarding the ancestral figure would have developed. So, for example, Abraham is typically connected in Genesis with southern Canaan. Isaac appears linked specifically with Beersheba. And the stories about Jacob are going to link him with the north, primarily with Shechem and with Bethel. And he's also connected with Gilead in Genesis as well. So by using this evidence, some biblical scholars have suggested that the traditions about Abraham derive from oral legends and stories about an early patriarchal ancestor that were told by the people from the Judean Hill Country. And the Isaac narratives that we have in Genesis may be traditions regarding an ancient figure recounted by the people who inhabited southwestern Judah and Negev. But Jacob, remember, connected with northern regions, may actually be the earliest or most ancient of these ancestral traditions. His stories, Jacob's stories, were perhaps told over the centuries by a group of people from the central Ephraimite hills. So this theory that I've just discussed is often called by biblical scholars the history of traditions. And it really makes sense of the fact that Jacob's name was also known as Israel, and that this is the title by which the people who occupied the heartland of the country were known. And according to this historical reading, these patriarchal stories from Genesis that we've been discussing connected these separate legendary figures as a single family group may have been created by the biblical authors to increase cohesiveness between the population of Canaan amongst this people that eventually came to be known as Israel.
Yeah. You know what? Jared Anderson kind of introduced this in our Patriarchal Blessings one, where he even talked about the 12 tribes as being almost constructed to be brothers.
Yes.
In a way of yes. sort of doing this. How solid is that in terms of scholarship? Is it a minority position?
I think it's, it's not something that can be proven in a scientific sense, but it does make sense of a lot of the issues of why certain patriarchs are linked together as allies and from the same mother, and their stories evolve from various geographical regions and focus on that. So like any academic theory, it is something that we cannot establish scientifically as absolute fact, but it does make sense of a lot of the evidence that we have in the account. It's something that our audience definitely should be aware of, exists as a conversation amongst biblical scholars.
Okay, so if we're to look at that to its logical conclusion, Abraham might not have been the father of Isaac, who might not have been the father of Jacob, who became Israel. In this theory, it's possible that this was written in to show these relationships.
Yeah, that is a possibility.
Fascinating. That's a big paradigm changer.
Sure, if it's correct.
You know, the way you were describing this, David, in terms of these different geographic locations that are kind of coming together later on, was there also a literary purpose behind some of that? In terms of, look at Robert Alter's book, The Art of Biblical Narrative, where he's talking about these well scenes as kind of a type scene.
Yep.
Is that kind of playing into what you're saying here? Where these are late. I mean, if the camels hadn't been domesticated back in the time of Isaac, do they become more of a literary device later on? You know, the well is a literary device. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, I think so, because it's in that from that angle. Then these relationships are, you know, even the antagonistic ones with Canaanites are an effort on the part of the authors to define the historical reality of their own time period by reading back into history things that perhaps did not take place. So, for instance, the Philistines are mentioned in the Genesis stories, even though the Philistines did not appear in the land of Canaan until the 12th century. So like the camels that we've been discussing, the Philistines, when they're mentioned in Genesis, that's an anachronism. So perhaps a reference to, you know, the realities as the authors understood them, and, you know, projecting that reality back into the past. The same is true for the Armenians. They assume a prominent role in the Genesis account concerning Jacob, but they're only attested in the 11th century BCE. And Abraham's story, as I mentioned a few minutes earlier, it describes and links him. You know, he can talk about the town of Beersheba. Yet we know from archaeological evidence that Beersheba was not settled before the 12th century. Mm. So these types of anachronisms appear all throughout the book of Genesis. And for critical scholars, they certainly call into question the historical reliability of the accounts.
Right.
And so are we kind of looking at these as these ancient editors, writers, as kind of doing presentism for their time? Is that what you're saying?
Sure.
Yeah, and if I remember Jared Anderson's point when he talked about it with the 12 tribes, it's because it's post-Babylonian captivity when these are all being written, and you're trying to assemble a people together, you know, so you make them blood brothers or something like that. So is that about the period that we think that Jay was writing, was post-exile?
No, it's Jay's earlier than that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it's, so I would read that a little bit differently. I would say it's a desire, if this theory is correct. I'm not saying that it is, but if it's correct, then I would see it as much earlier than that, and as a desire on the part of the biblical authors to create cohesiveness amongst these tribes that already and have national identity prior to the exile.
Could I add something here that kind of started this theory in motion? If we look at chapter 25, verses 25 through 28, where nations were known by their ancestors, Esau is, you know, red, obviously, a play on Edom, and the term hairy, a play on Seir, the mountain range, you know, in the southeast where the Dead Sea, where the Edomites lived. The term heel is a related verb, you know, for overreach, you know, showing where Jacob lived, you know, as a herdsman. And I think there are many things we see in the text that do point to geographical locations, aren't there, just by giving the background of the people who are mentioned, like God protects Jacob, Yaakov, and other things like that also tie him to covenant promise and blessing that are contained in the narrative.
I think that's great. I love the way that Tom has linked that history of traditions idea specifically with the story of Jacob and Esau and geographical regions. And yeah, I think that's well said. It makes sense of a lot of the evidence that we have in the text, but it's not this isn't a hard science, right? We can't prove it or establish it. It's an academic theory.
Yeah. That's good. Good to have out there. So thanks. Let's move quickly. I'm trying to get us all the way through 27. So let's go through 25 quite quickly. David, will you take the lead?
Sure. So chapter 25, then, as we transition, we read about Abraham marrying a second wife, and then we have this genealogical list that will introduce us to Ishmael's seed and their importance and relevance to the patriarchal traditions that are presented in Genesis. All of this from a biblical perspective, however, is really not nearly as significant as verse 19, where we read, "And these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. And Abraham begat Isaac." Remember that formula is a priestly formula. These are the generations of heaven and earth. These are the generations of Adam. These are the generations of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Noah. Anytime that formula appears, we transition into the priestly source or document. It's a transition marker. Then this introduces what follows, right? That this emphasis now will be given on Isaac, the son of Abraham. Abraham will pass away. And we read that verse 20, Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife. Verse 21, Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren. There's that barren wife motif that appears all throughout Genesis, right? Just in the same way that Isaac's mother, Sarah, was barren, and that even the favored wife, Rachel, for Jacob, she will be barren. It tends, and then to think about Hannah and the story of Samuel, it's a motif that runs all throughout the Hebrew Bible that shows God's intervention in the life of the hero from the time of conception, that there has to be a miraculous birth because God is directly involved with this ancestor's history and his life story.
So interesting. So I said we're going to go fast, but here I am interrupting you with just a quick question. It says here that Isaac is 40 years old when he gets married. Now, is this 40 as in 40 days and 40 nights and 40 years in the desert? It just means a big number. It's one of those, you know, biblical, you know, numbers that mean lots of different things. Or is he really 40 years old? And if he is actually 40 years old, is that a little bit late to get married in ancient society?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know precisely what it's, yeah, it could be a number thing, but it could be meant to be taken literally as well.
Okay, well, let's move on. So Rebecca conceives miraculously, and now she's got twins in her womb that are fighting with each other, and she kind of gets a prayer or a blessing or an answer to a prayer about what's going on.
Yep. And verse 23, she inquires of the Lord, and the Lord said unto her, which is wonderful, because here's Yahweh now speaking to this woman and giving her special insights and understanding regarding his will for the family, the chosen patriarchal family, again, emphasizing Rebekah's great power. And then verse 23, the Lord said unto her, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. The one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. Okay, and when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there it is again, twins in her womb. Notice that the King James translation italicizes the words "there were," and that's a marker that the King James needs to add in some English words to make sense of the Hebrew syntax. And well, that's just is necessary when you don't understand the presentative nature of the word "behold," switching to her perspective. Two children, two twins in her womb. Verse 25, the first one came out red all over like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. Father Tom mentioned this. I don't know if he wants to talk about that again, the word play that's happening there between Esau and red.
Yeah, it's basically also representing nations. Esau is red, a play on Edom for hairy. Also is a play on Seir, the mountain range in the southeast of the Dead Sea, where the Edomites lived. And then you also, you know, have the term hunter mentioned. Jacob is connected to the noun heel, a reflective verb to overreach or you're sort of gasping in the first place. So that gives us some clues to a civilized herdsman. Actually, the name Jacob is extremely old, meaning Jacob El, God protects. So it's just further clues by the names and the verbs that are used that give us a clue what's going on behind the scenes.
Okay, so now we have Esau, and he comes out all hairy and red.
Yep. And then verse 26, then came out his brother, and his brother took hold of Esau's heel. And the word for heel in Hebrew is akev, and it has the same letters as the Hebrew name Yaakov or Jacob. And so this does seem to be another illustration of the desire to create puns out of people's names all throughout Genesis. And because Tom actually gives us the more historically correct etymology of the name Jacob, as El, God protects, or something of that nature. But just as we're going to see in Moses in Exodus, when it talks about being drawn out of the water in connection with his name, biblical authors really aren't concerned with historical etymology and linguistics as much as they are in word plays and puns. And yet the name Jacob also really means trickster. And this becomes important for the narrative because his whole life will involve trickery. And it reflects something that scholars often refer to as name causation or causality, that a name is so significant or important that it actually affects the courses of events that take place in a person's life. So Jacob's name means trickster. He will trick Esau into giving him the birthright promise in the next pericope. He'll trick his father into giving him the blessing. He himself will be tricked then by his father-in-law, Laban, into marrying the wrong sister and to working for an extra 7 years. It's trickery, trickery, trickery. All of this takes place with his life until eventually he receives a name change to Israel, one who strives with and succeeds with God, something along those lines. So, yeah, it again shows what's going on from a literary perspective.
Okay, so let's keep going. We've got the boys growing, and he talks a little bit about their characters.
Verse 27, Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man, dwelling in tents, we read. So going back to the concept of Esau's hairiness, this seems to emphasize the distinction between the two boys. Of course, Israel's ancestor, a lot more settled and refined, and Esau, who's ultimately will be connected with the Arab people, is much less so from their perspective. Verse 28, Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. It's a good point then to interject and talk about, you know, it's sometimes one of the reasons why Genesis is so difficult for Latter-day Saints is, I think, because we tend to hold prophets, seers, and revelators up on a pedestal where we don't feel that they make mistakes in life and that everything that they do is justified and in direct harmony in accordance with the divine will. And that's just not the perspective that the biblical authors have. If we overlook their weaknesses and their frailties and imperfections, then we miss that the fact that these authors want to emphasize sometimes they were just petty. Sometimes they made mistakes, and we're supposed to recognize that as readers so that we can learn from that and learn to avoid the mistakes that they made.
Brother David, isn't there also the Middle Eastern idea that even though we sin and fall and all our frailties are in the narrative, yet God still gets his will done anyway?
Yes, that's a great point. That's a great also if we overlook their weaknesses and characteristics, then which often happens in LDS readings, then we do miss that important theological idea as well. Thank you, Father Tom. That's great.
We probably won't get to Jacob's wrestle, with God until the next time we convene. But on this favoritism business, I just have to share something right here. I'm influenced a lot by an article by Rick Jepson in Sunstone Magazine that I published when I was the editor. And one of the angles that he took on this idea of favoritism is sort of like we all are sort of uncomfortable with certain aspects of ourselves. And when we see somebody who's completely opposite from us or who has different characteristics, we kind of admire those because we kind of wish that those were our characteristics too. And so the idea in this piece is that perhaps Jacob was much more like Isaac, passive, dwelled in tents, maybe more studious, more quiet, where we had this wild brother who was the hunter, the gatherer, the, you know, beat the chest, He-Man type guy. And you know, Isaac would naturally just like, oh man, he's got those qualities that I wish I had. And it would also come across as like, a negative or, you know, a lack of favoritism or no respect for the younger son. Does that make sense?
I like that. I think that's great.
And then the other thing I wanted to bring up here too is this whole business of, you know, I love this meat. I want this. You make such great meat and things like this. It reminds me a lot, David, of kind of the stuff early on in Genesis. You know, there in those first five or six verses or chapters of Genesis or something, when Yahweh is like loving the smell of the sacrifices that the humans would send up, and it's like, you know, get that sweet smoke, baby, and all that kind of stuff. And do you think there's any kind of tie between on the author here? I'm assuming that they're both are J author. Is there some kind of tie there between the smoke going up to Yahweh and it pleasing to him and Isaac? Do you think that's an intention?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I, one of my favorite articles that I've had a chance to publish was actually under Brian's help as editor of the Maxwell Institute Journal Studies in the Bible and Antiquity. And I did a piece, and Brian was the editor of that, where I talked specifically about that, the connection that we see in the subsequent pericope of the sacrificial nature and ritualization of the account connected with Yahweh partaking of food. And yeah, we can get to that. So I think I have a lot to offer that I could offer on that. And I had one more point to add quickly then on this idea of favoritism that we see in the patriarchal narratives. If we jump forward for just a minute to Genesis chapter 37, we have that priestly formula, verse 2. These are the generations of Jacob. And then we read immediately, Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And from a literary perspective, it's almost then as if Jacob is treating Joseph as an only son, as if he's the only reflection of the generation of Jacob, and it prepares us for the favoritism, and that ultimately causes so much discord and disharmony in the family and leads to the problems that they experience. So we can't overlook that.
Very good. Awesome. Yeah, this favoritism always is weird and strange for us.
Nepotism!
Yes. So returning then to chapter 25, we read that this incredible story about Esau. He's very, very hungry. He's been out unsuccessful in his efforts to acquire food. And verse 30, he says, I'm faint. And verse 31, Jacob says, well, sell me this day thy birthright. Difficult to say precisely what that birthright entails in the mind of the biblical author. The first son traditionally in ancient Israelite culture received extra benefits and perks in terms of land and ownership and responsibilities. It's something along those lines from the author's
something
perspective.
Like twice as much. You get twice as much as any other.
Yeah, I mean, those are the later biblical laws, but to what extent they would have had a reflection here, it's difficult to say. I think the benefit of that is recognizing that there is this very great tradition that the eldest is favored, and culturally, politically, historically, and yet what's interesting is that time and time again in the story of Genesis, Yahweh doesn't favor the oldest. He actually favors the younger son.
That's
and
right.
That's the case with Cain and Abel, right? And it's the case even in the Book of Mormon with Laman, Lemuel, and Sam, and then Nephi. So it's kind of interesting to show that despite cultural traditions that the firstborn should be the favorite, really Yahweh intervenes and shows he always takes the position of the little guy.
Very cool. Okay, so Esau goes, yeah, man, birthright's not doing me any good right this minute. I'm starving.
Exactly. So
tell us the rest.
So then
give
he
me
says,
that red porridge, that cream of wheat.
Yeah, a bunch of lentils, right? Then he says, verse 32, I am, well, what point is it? I'm dying here, so give me some food. And Jacob said, swear to me, verse 33, this day, and he swear unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. Then verse 34, Jacob gave Esau bread and lentils, and he said, and then the verbs are just very quick, and it just kind of shows how, again, Esau is kind of this uncivilized person. He just eats, drinks, gets up, goes his way. And then Esau despised his birthright, verse 34.
Some of the modern translations I like it say lentil stew. Mm.
The famous mess of pottage, selling your birthright. We've done a lot of theologizing on that, haven't we? Brian, anything in this Jacob Esau stuff from the traditions that you're familiar with? Go for it.
Yes. One of my favorite books is James Kugel's Traditions of the Bible. And he really tries to go at this stories, these Bible stories, from an ancient perspective. And so he says that the interpreters probably asked the following questions. Why is Esau the fall guy? I mean, that's probably our question more than theirs. Why is Esau the fall guy in these stories? How do we explain Jacob's seemingly deceitful behavior in this story? Because he does this later on with putting on the animal skins to make himself Esau to get the blessing as well. And how do we juxtapose that with Jacob's earlier behavior, which seems to counter, or I'm sorry, Jacob's later behavior, which seems to counter that? A guy devoted to God, he's heedless of material possessions, he promises his tithes to God. I mean, he's just very righteous. He even sees God. How do we square that? Kugel suggests that the early interpreters tried to find evidence that could prove that whatever evil happened to Esau was justified. And it starts very early on with verse 25 in chapter 20, or 27 in chapter 25, where Esau's a cunning hunter and Jacob's a plain man dwelling in tents. And the early interpreters, and some of this might be this ancient presentism, okay, that we've talked about earlier, but plain man, plain, the word is coming from the Hebrew tam, which is the word for complete, whole, perfect, simple, and you even see that in the very footnote here, 27b. And so the ancient interpreters really built on that, that Jacob was perfect, that Jacob was really a good guy. He was without guile. And the tents part, he didn't dwell in just one tent. He dwelt in other tents. And probably another tent would have been that he was in a school. He learned to read and write. He not just staying at home. And the presentism comes in where some of the Jewish interpreters have Jacob at a yeshiva almost, you know, learning Torah, this kind of thing, which very anachronistic, of course, doesn't fit at all. But what you're seeing here is you're seeing this case being built for the goodness of Jacob, who can't really do anything wrong. And so anything he does that's against Esau is justified, okay?
Yeah.
And Esau, they demonize him, okay? He's the bad guy. And it even comes out later with the Edomites and the Amalekites, who God hates, okay? And that reflects back on Esau as kind of the progenitor of that. And even all the way up into the Roman period, we've got some traditions that are talking about the Romans being descendants of Esau.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, as the bad guy.
Interesting.
And so,
because Esau sort of redeems himself through the later chapters here, so the men means they must be sort of skipping it over, because, you know, first he wants to swear revenge and stuff, but then, you know, when Jacob has the wrestle and he's all afraid to go across the river and he's sending everybody out, Esau's ready to forgive him. The two reunite together when they bury their father. It seems like they go along their merry ways, and it's like Esau kind of grew up and got perspective.
Yeah, that's not the way it comes out, though, in the Jewish traditions at all. I mean, listen to this. Genesis Rabbah, for instance, this goes all the way back to in your utero here. When she, that would be Rebecca, passed by houses of idol worship, Esau would squirm about, trying to get out. As it says,
oh, man.
the wicked turn astray from the womb.
Oh, man.
And when she would pass synagogues for study houses, Jacob would squirm to get out. As it says, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. You see what the traditions are doing there.
Like you say, presentism gone amok, and yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the infancy narratives of Jesus and what a perfect child he was and all that.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Very
in the Near Eastern narrative, it almost requires that you have a troublemaker or a tempter to make God's righteousness covenantally come to pass.
Well, fun. Brian, was there anything in the Muslim world on these stories at this point?
The Muslims kind of pick it up a little bit later on, the story. So,
all right. So, David, I think we're through with 25. We've got to go through 26 here. I don't know how much we want to do. You decide. We have about 20 minutes before we lose Brian.
Okay, then let's not focus too much on 26. An interesting chapter, primarily, I guess, from a narrative perspective, because, again, Esau is presented as marrying and the indigenous wives, and therefore this is upsetting to his parents.
Right.
And it does link him and whatever negativity may be presented to him in the text or in later Jewish tradition with the indigenous population of Canaan and separates it from Israel's ancestral patriarchal figure, Jacob.
And this is where the Philistines come in anachronistically.
Yes.
This is Abimelech.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
King of Philistines.
Okay. You also have anachronism in 26:5, where the commandments, statutes, and laws, which some of the Jewish interpreters will say, well, in oral form, you know, in the Mishnah, they existed. But when you read the biblical narrative, they weren't codified at that time.
Yep.
So what in 26, though, because I agree with you, Esau marrying outside of the family's lineage is a big deal here, but what else is in 26 that makes it?
I think that's what I would, when I teach it, and there's only so much time, I usually give emphasis to that.
Yeah, all this well business and digging it and getting it. And again, it does illustrate what you talked about earlier, though. They're trying to set it up that, yeah, he's dwelling among these people, but they're basically... It's a very cool relationship between each other, and he doesn't always get his way because the political forces don't want him there.
Yes, and you also have, of course, the story with Isaac and Abimelech, where Isaac is going to again follow the tradition of the patriarchal tradition of trying to escape
She's my sister. She's not my
wife. It's the same sort of narrative that we find repeated in the Abraham tradition. So, again, this seems to be evidence to a lot of people that we're not dealing with actual historical.
Again, more like a literary device here going on, as we talked about earlier. So,
yeah.
Yeah. But again, with the political situation here, it's like, what if one of our guys had decided to lie with your wife? Then we would have been at war.
Yeah.
You know, so again, it just shows that you're here, you're powerful, you're rich, but you're not one of us, is what he's trying to get across there.
Exactly.
So, okay. Esau, the very end of it, Esau was 40 years old when he took to wife Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite. And this was the grief to Isaac and Rebekah. So you're right. That's just one of the key points of 26.
Yes. Which then helps us transition to really one of the most provocative stories in the entire Hebrew Bible. This the deception that takes place on Jacob and Rebekah's part against Isaac, the patriarchal figure. And it's just a fascinating narrative. We pick it up in 27, verse 1. It came to pass that when Isaac was old, now watch the literary repetition. Isaac was old. His eyes were dim. He could not see. Right? He called Esau, his eldest son, and said unto him, my son. And he said unto him, behold, here I am. And he said, behold, now I am old. I know that the day of my death, I know the day of my death. Therefore, take, I pray thee, thy weapons, thy quiver, and thy bow and go out to the field and take me some venison. Verse 4, make me savory meat such as I love. And there's this emphasis upon the word love in the account that links a strong feeling that Isaac has with the meat, together with the feeling and sentiment that he has with for and towards Esau. Back in Genesis chapter 25, verse 28, Isaac loved Esau. So he loves Esau, he loves the meat, and the two things work together in terms of his preference for this child.
Now, would they have been, they're agrarian people, right? They're not really hunter-gatherers at all. So is it sort of like a treat to have meat?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I guess they're killing their flocks all the time for meat. Yeah, so okay, and then maybe it's wild game that he particularly has an affection for.
It might be. But what he says is interesting. He says, make me the food in order that my soul may bless you before I die. And why? And this was interesting to me because this seemed to be, in my mind, a correspondence between presenting the food offering to the patriarch and then receiving a blessing from his hand. And so as I kind of, in my own studies, as I worked on that, it ended up turning into, as I mentioned, an article that I did for Brian and the Maxwell Institute a few years back, where I talked about the ritualization that appears all throughout this particular narrative that plays upon sacrificial themes, where you already hinted towards this, Dan, in your analysis, when you commented that, Isaac assumes the position of God, smelling the meat, receiving this, and then the sacrifice or presentation is presented for in order to receive a blessing on the part of Jacob here. And I really believe that that's what's happening in terms of the narrative. There is this play on the distinction between sacrifice and offering that exists in the Hebrew Bible, one that we often don't make as contemporary commentators. Sacrifice places, which takes place in the Hebrew Bible, places an emphasis upon the ritual slaughtering or killing of the animal, but an offering was typically a food offering where you would literally feed the god and show, therefore, that you care about his existence or her existence, as the case may be. Because that's the way, that's one of the, if you feed someone, it's food is necessary to sustain life, and so that's transformed into the ritual sphere where feeding God shows your respect and love and honor and that his existence matters to you. So in the same way that, for example, if in our contemporary society, if I offend my neighbor, I might bring over chocolate chip cookies and say, I'm sorry, right?
Nice.
And give that to the neighbor. And in giving someone to something, or think about the old tradition of bringing the teacher an apple, right? It's hoping that the teacher will show favor on you. Well, this is transferred into the ritual sphere in ancient Israelite culture. So presenting God with meat secures a blessing. We can link that, for example, with Leviticus chapter 1, verse 4. We read about ritual offering and presentation of food or meat to Yahweh, where we read that the presenter shall put his hand upon the head of the burnt offering. This single hand gesture ritually was very significant. What it seemed to designate was that by the laying on of a single hand upon an offering, it shows that that offering belongs to you. So whatever blessings that Yahweh is going to dispense, because he receives this gesture, this gift, they should be given right to you because of the laying on of the single hand. So he put his hand upon the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted to him to make an atonement for him. So you receive the perks, the blessings of presenting an offering to God. And that's precisely then what's happening in this narrative with Jacob and Esau and Isaac. So he says, make me the meat, and then I'm going to give you the blessing. Returning then to chapter 27, verse 5, Rebekah hears this, and she turns and she tells Jacob, look, verse 6, I heard thy father speaking unto Esau. Verse 7, bring me venison. She's reporting his dialogue. Make me savory meat so that I may eat and bless you. And then she adds this cultic ritual formulation, before the Lord. And that also is a trigger for readers to recognize that there's a sacrificial theme happening here, because in most of the cases where the expression before the Lord is used in the Hebrew Bible, it designates a temple location and experience. Where else would one go to appear before the Lord if not the temple or the shrine? So again, it ties into the sacrificial themes that permeate throughout this entire narrative.
So he's going to do something big. I've had the Lord's told me that this is not the right order, and therefore we got to stop this. That's
so and so then she convinces him to take this, and then you know it's interesting to do this deception, and he's very leery and says, "Well, my dad will curse me. He'll find out." And she verse 13 and says, "Well, upon me be thy curse, my son. Only obey my voice and go fetch me them. You go do it." And make this deception. And then verse 15, the ritualization and sacrificial and temple theme continues, because we read that Rebekah took goodly raiment of her eldest son Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them upon Jacob, her younger son.
So his nicest clothes that he wouldn't be hunting in, but yet it would be appropriate for
exactly. There's no reason to emphasize that he's putting on this sacred ceremonial, you know, these sacred ceremonial garments for this temple experience. Unless you wanted to talk about the ritualization of it and the blessing and what's taking place here. So then she takes the food, verse 17. She gave the savory meat and the bread which she had prepared, and then we add into the hand of her son Jacob. So in the same way that as I present an offering to God and receive blessings for presenting that through a laying on of hand, Jacob is going to designate this offering that he's presenting to Isaac, his father, and that he should deserve to receive the blessing by putting it into his own hand. And the hand theme continues all throughout, because then as the count continues, we read that, of course, remember, he puts on the hairy garment, and then Jacob, verse 22, Jacob went near unto Isaac, his father, and he felt him, and he said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And he discerned him not, because his hands were hairy, and his brother's Esau's, as his brother Esau's hands. And so he blessed him." So again, the emphasis that this offering comes from the hands of Jacob, who has disguised his hands to be the hands of Esau, and receives this in the same way that you would lay on a hand for a ritual presentation offering in the temple.
Nice. Brian, I know you have to leave. Are you, is there anything either to this point or anything else in this chapter 27 before you take off?
Yeah, with the blessing, what the ancient interpreters tried to do in Judaism was to, again, clear Jacob of any wrongdoing. Because if you read in verse 18 and 19 of chapter 27, he came unto his father and said, "My father," and he said, "Here am I. Who art thou, my son?" And Jacob said unto his father, "I am Esau, thy firstborn." So the text makes it sound like a flat-out lie. But the interpreters in some of the Midrash, they changed that. In one Midrash, it says, "And Jacob said, I am Esau, your firstborn." He stopped in the middle. He said, "I am, but Esau is your firstborn." In other words, he's separating so he's not lying. And so they're trying to clear him of any wrongdoing there. And the other thing that they try to do, the ancient interpreters, is to say, well, this was God's will for Jacob to have this blessing, not Esau. And so in Jubilees it says, "And he, Isaac, did not recognize him, but there was an ordering from heaven to turn his mind astray." Another one is from a Targum. "It came to pass that when Isaac was old and his eyes were too weak to see, and the Holy Spirit departed from him, so that Jacob would receive the blessing." And so it's God's will that Jacob be blessed. And so they had to grapple with that. You know, how do we explain Jacob coming out in the text here saying, you know, a lie in a sense. And so I just wanted to kind of add that.
Well, you know, within Mormonism, we don't worry so hard about it, because lying for the Lord is okay.
Yeah.
There's some to do this. Where here, you know, the text is presented that you know, Rebecca got this vision or this communication from God that this is the things that are supposed to be happening, and Isaac's kind of, you know, unaware of this, but she knows, and so this is all right, but they're still worried about that extra layer of evil.
They are. They are. And we Latter-day Saints, we kind of work through that, that Abraham didn't lie, that Jacob, you know, that even if they did, it was God's will to do it, in a sense.
Right, and, yeah, so it's okay. The ends justify the means.
Ends justify the means, that's right. Well, the ancient interpreters didn't go that route, so.
Right.
Do you want me to go ahead and do my closing thing now?
Yeah, do whatever else you
well,
have.
I just wanted to say I'm so pleased that I can be a part of this august group. I'm honored to be here, and it's been a really wonderful experience to kind of go through these verses together and learn so much, and I'm just grateful for that. So thank you so much.
We'll keep you on the team, brother.
Thank you.
And, no, Father, it was wonderful to have you, Brother Brian. You're a blessing to the team.
Thank you, Father Tom. And David, brother, love you, and hope to talk to you soon.
Good. Thanks, Brian, for everything.
Listeners, we're only going to finish up through the end of chapter 27. So, David, when you're ready, please take us away on that.
So then, as we continue then the sacrificial theme, we read that, you know, verse 24, art thou my very son Esau? He said, I am. And verse 25, he said, bring it near to me, and I will eat of my son's venison, so that my soul may bless thee. So there's a direct correspondence between presenting food and receiving a blessing, in the same way that there's a connection between presenting food to Yahweh. And by the way, the offerings throughout the Hebrew Bible are often defined as food. The altar is described as a table. There's a reason why salt is added to a ritual offering, because it makes it smell better and it makes the food taste better, right? So there really is a direct connection here that an ancient audience would have been sensitive to as they read this, between what takes place in the Israelite cult and or temple and what's happening here in this blessing ritual. In fact, it goes so far as to say in verse 27 that Jacob came near him, and Isaac kisses him. And verse 27, he kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his raiment and blessed him and said, see, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field which the Lord hath blessed. And remember, oftentimes it was perceived that the way you feed God is that he smells the food presented in the offering. We even saw that happening in Genesis chapter 9, verse 21. Remember, where God smells the offering that Noah makes, and then gives him the blessing afterwards that he will no longer curse the earth. So there's a connection there as well as this ritualization theme continues.
Keep going, brother.
Okay, so he gives him the blessing. Isaac makes the discovery that he's been deceived, and he says, oh, well, this must be God's will anyway, right? And I just to sum it, you can't undo it. And then Esau comes in and says, well, Father, verse 38, do you have one more blessing for me? And he cries, and Isaac, his father, answers, verse 39, and said, and behold, I'll give you one. Thy dwelling shall be the fatness of the earth and the dew of the heaven from above. Well, that's good. And by thy sword shalt thou live. And that's good, because he's going to live, even if he's going to have a lot of conflict. And then the negativity. Thou shalt serve thy brother, and it shall come to pass, when thou shalt have the dominion, that thou shalt break his yoke from off thy neck. So, here's a reference again to the political realities that take place later between Israelites and Canaanites. And verse 41, Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing that his father had blessed him with. And so much so that Rebekah comes to him and says, well, you better leave. You better go to Laban, my brother, to Haran, and then find a wife while you're there that's not an indigenous Canaanite wife. So that's basically the end of this fascinating episode that, you know, as Brian said, has really challenged religious interpreters throughout the ages. I think it is challenging even for a Latter-day Saint audience. I mean, even though we recognize lying for the Lord perhaps as something that is virtuous in certain narratives and historical traditions as Latter-day Saints, you're still left with the question, why, you know, if Isaac is a prophet, why didn't he recognize what was due and who should it be the birthright son? And, you know, I think we struggle with this as well.
Well, I've often found it interesting about the narratives, you know, that refer to the neck, you know, and the smoothness, you know, of the skin, you know, that it talks about, you know, when this deception is taking place, and the blessing that ultimately happens, you know, when Rebecca steps in, you know, where he says, "I'm tired of living because of the daughters of Heth. If Jacob takes a wife from the daughters of Heth, let these be the daughters in the land, you know, which good will my life be to me?" You know, he asks.
Right.
It's just fascinating that they create this tension and these problems, and then God steps in and fixes it His way. You know, as we were saying earlier, and in Christian tradition, unfortunately, the Calvinists kind of get a hold of this, and you know, they act like God's will is inflexible. You know, and that God doesn't work with His people, you know, on working out, you know, these solutions. But in a Near Eastern mindset, that's exactly what God is doing. He's moving with the people from behind the scenes and working with them to actually bring His ultimate will to pass.
That's good. That's great.
Okay, so larger question here. So this is Rebecca. Isaac seems to think, I know he ends up living a lot longer than just this, but he kind of presents this, like, before I die, come let me have this great wild venison broth that I love so much, and let me give you a blessing. So anyway, she's sitting there, and she senses it's a ritual situation, that there's priesthood, this is going to be, you know, sort of the spiritual culmination. Does that seem to be right, that, you know, he's about to give a priesthood blessing, and she sees it and wants to make sure it happens?
Well, it's often interpreted as priesthood from a Latter-day Saint perspective. I think that's anachronistic. We really don't have the concept of priesthood in the Hebrew Bible. I mean, well, you have Melchizedek, who's talked about a priest, but priesthood really is something that kind of has its origins from a biblical perspective, at least for Israelites, with Aaron. And so that's a little bit anachronistic. It really, if we look at the blessing itself, it seems to be a continuation of this promise of favoritism and chosenness that Abraham receives, that is extended to Isaac, and that will now continue through Jacob's lineage and ultimately then be given to for Israel. If we return back and remember the purposes we discussed earlier of the Akedah, or the binding, the purpose seems to be to explain why God favored and had a special relationship with Abraham's posterity. But some of the narratives we skipped over talked about the fact that, you know, Abraham's posterity is larger than just simply Israel itself. So we have to explain why that special union and bond and relationship perpetuates from Isaac, from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob, and then ultimately to the 12 tribes. And really, that is what Rebecca is perpetuating in her efforts to intervene and take matters into her own hands, is that special, distinct relationship with Yahweh.
And it not only affects the Near East, but many nations in Genesis 49.
Yeah, you read my mind, Tom. I was going to go to Genesis 49, and, you know, every time you get it in our Sunday school classes or something like that, we start talking about this is the moment of the patriarchal blessings, you know, that Jacob is Jacob is giving to all of the 12 sons. And even if we don't want to go that far there to kind of like too tie it to too much like what today's Mormon patriarchs do, David, would you say that this is sort of something that the patriarch of any clan, of any family back in the ancient Mideast would be doing this sort of thing from time to time, or at least near the time of his death?
Definitely. Definitely. And that's a good one to link it to, because it shows that a patriarchal blessing from a biblical perspective is predictive, and it's going to affect the course of human history, and especially a patriarchal blessing that is given at a deathbed. like this instance is, you know, it has seems to have special efficacy, or the a case in Genesis 49 with Jacob and his sons. So that is a great link to make there, without question.
Yeah, yeah, I was just curious about that. So, you know, now I can picture pretty much any time in the ancient Middle East, especially near the time of a death or perceived time of death, the patriarch of the clan might gather all of his families together and offer some sort of blessing, some sort of predictive nature, or at least like, here's what I hope and dream for you, and may my God be listening to this plea. Is that about right?
Yeah. Yeah, if we read the actual blessing, he says here, this is again returning to 27, verse 28, therefore, God give thee of the dew of the heaven, the fatness of the earth, the plenty of corn and wine. Let people serve thee, and nations bow down to thee. Be Lord over thy brethren, you know, which includes, you know, he is the one who's going to continue this special dominant relationship. And let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be everyone that curseth thee. Blessed be he that blesseth thee, and a perpetuation of that special favoritism and is going to continue then through him.
Yeah, then it says in verse 29, and the nations will bow down to you.
Which is a reflection then of what Israel views its own role as one who rules.
That's right, especially later in the prophets when they'll rise to be the pinnacle and the law will flow forth from Zion.
Excellent, excellent, yes.
Okay, just a little bit more. So here's Isaac. He's intending this blessing for Esau. He thinks he has Esau under his hand. He says it. Then he realizes he's duped. Why just doesn't he undo it and say, cancel that one, wrong dude? Is there some sort of sense in the ancient world that once you pronounce a blessing, you know, you can't undo it?
It ties back to that concept that these are predictions, right? These are predictions that are being made and written from a critical perspective in hindsight to describe the position and relationship that Israel views itself holding in amongst the nations. But, you know, it cannot be taken back.
Sorry to interrupt you. Okay, you're Isaac. You've got your hands on his head. Let's think about the situation here. I want to give this guy a blessing. I send him out purposely to go hunting for me and letting him know that when he comes back, I'm going to give this blessing. So I've been planning this ahead of time. I've figured out what it is that I want to bless Esau with. So is it a question of, like, under his hand, he is now pronouncing a blessing? I would guess you'd think in his own mind it's the same one that he'd been planned, or is it really something so different that he feels like he can't go back on it because of that? Or why can't he, you know, just like, okay, psychologically for Esau's sake, say, dude, I'm going to give you a blessing. It's already the one that I've been planning to give you. It's kind of the one I gave your brother, but it's going to sound a little bit similar, but I guess I just don't quite get it. Is it priesthood? Is it not priesthood? You already said it wasn't. Is it the spirit that, you know, he felt it coming through him? So that also added to why he can't undo it and give the same blessing he had planned to.
You know, I think it's a matter of, it's hard to say psychologically, but as a prediction that he is making, if we read in verse 33 that when he learns that he's given the blessing to someone else, Isaac trembled very exceedingly and said, who? Where is he that hath taken venison and brought it to me? And I have eaten of all before thou camest and have blessed him. Yea, he shall be blessed. It cannot be taken back. It's an interesting theological view. It's your right to question.
Yeah, because nowadays you can, like, hey, yeah, stop, cancel that,
cancel,
you know, control,
cancel
alt,
that
delete,
feeling,
you know, something like that.
Well, yeah, because in the Middle East, a pronouncement cannot be rescinded. It's done through later biblical narrative as well, as edicts of kings and priests and everything else. Even in the book of Esther, that is certainly true. You know, when the people are asked to take up arms and defend themselves, you know, with the murder of Haman and so forth. And you know, so it's understood throughout the world, once these oral words have been spoken, you can't go back on them. You can create other scenarios to deal with them, but you can't rescind them.
As a critical student of the Bible, I would add that, you know, all as fascinating as these theological questions are to ask, and we should ask them, ultimately, the narratives are created in such a way to explain historical reality. So we, you know, it's just like, of course he can't take it back, because that would defeat the political a purpose and agenda that the authors have for presenting Israel as the heir to Abraham's promises. Yeah, it's a humanistic perspective, but I think it's one that needs to be retained as we read these accounts.
Well, thanks, David and Tom and Brian, who's already left, but we are going to have a great time when we reconvene here for the second half of this and talk about Jacob.
Oh, there's a lot to talk about. That'll be wonderful.
Any final thoughts, Tom?
No final thoughts, other than just to say what a marvelous team we have here. And I take notes and learn things as well and go back and check and recheck. So, you know, like they say, you know, your teachers are also students. And I really feel blessed to be a part of a team like this. And I'm just amazed at the differences in our perspectives and gifts, and yet, you know, coming from our different perspectives and training, how it does coalesce together, doesn't it, in many respects? And, you know, as we create a large narrative out of the perspectives.
Thank you so much, Tom.
You're more than welcome.
Thank you so much. And I would just echo then Tom's feelings of gratitude for this opportunity to learn and participate and share. Hope it's edifying for our listeners. I would conclude by stating that I strongly believe that religious people should understand the Bible from an historical critical perspective, which is a lot of what we've done in these broadcasts. Historical meaning, how did these texts function in an original historical context? And critical meaning, talking about issues that are independent from any contemporary theological perspective. Now, granted, we've always returned back to LDS theology, but the ideas and understandings that we will come to regarding these texts are different when we take that perspective as opposed to a devotional reading, whether it's in Mormonism or Catholicism or whatever. And I think both have their value, and both have their place. One's not superior to the other. But what I've appreciated about these podcasts is it's provided us an opportunity to show that there's a lot to these texts when analyzed from a historical critical perspective. And once a religious person understands that, then the Bible becomes somewhat of a source book, where there are different ideas about culture, history, and theology that appear, some of which we can accept because we connect with, and others that we would perhaps reject. And both have advantages, both acceptance and rejection have advantages for a religious person who uses the Bible as a source book, as a springboard to jump further into light and knowledge that will accentuate and help draw closer to divinity on the part of the religious reader. So I'm grateful that we've been able to hopefully, you know, get that conversation started for our audience or continued so that they can make that journey together with us.
Yeah, that's exactly how it shakes out for me. You know, these podcasts and just what I kind of hope, you know, comes across, and it certainly does for me, is that, you know, these texts are interesting. They're fascinating. They're worth serious study. They give you perspectives and insight, and occasionally the drift of spirit or whatnot. But I don't know. I like the exercise of bringing myself to them. And yet, you know, this kind of historical knowledge and this background that we're kind of offering here, you know, helps me relax a little bit and gives me a little bit of breathing room that I don't have to accept every cultural custom as if it's binding for all time. And, you know, and I certainly don't need to take their scientific views of the heavens and the earth and all those kinds of different things. But I don't know. I'm just grateful for it as an exercise, kind of like what I think you were saying.
As a believer myself, I maintain that the scriptures have both humanity and divinity within them, and as do all revelations, and therefore that's precisely correct. That puts the responsibility upon us to use these texts to connect with the divine.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay, guys, reconvene with you soon.
Thank you, Dan.
May a blessing of our Father in Heaven be upon you all.
Thank you, Father Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well, all is well.